Hello, everyone. Welcome to Tea Time History Chat Live for the 1st of May 2024. I am actually an illusion today. I am currently at Hampton Court Palace taking the first of our The Anne Boleyn tours of the year. My name is Philippa Lacey Brule. This is the British History Channel. I'm here on YouTube, Facebook. I'm on Instagram, which if you want to follow along the tour, that's the best place to do it at British_History_Tours. I also have the British History Patreon. And like you've gathered, I run a company that does history tours. It's called British History Tours. And that is where I am currently at the moment. Hence why this is pre-recorded and not live this week. But I will be dropping back and having a look at comments. So please do let me know what you think about discussion today. I can't let this part of the year go by without talking about the downfall of Anne Boleyn. So unprecedented was it that I think that element can be lost because it's so familiar to us. And to that point, it almost loses its shock value. And I see it's quite common in comment sections to see almost pretty much a justification for what happened to her, in a sort of, well, she deserved it for the way she treated Catherine and Mary, her, obviously, Catherine of Aragon, Henry VIII's first wife, and her daughter Mary. Now, I'm no fangirl of Anne Boleyn in that I like to study her like I think we should study all people from history as human beings with all of their flaws and wonderfulness all mixed in together. And in fact, on the 14th of May, 12th of May for patrons, my interview with Dr. Estelle Peronc will be going live. And in that, she talks very much about Anne's flaws, which just make her more human. It just makes her, you know, she was a real person, and that is something to remember when we look at Anne's story. Now, the interview with Estelle is looking at concentrating on her links with France, so her time in France, and then and how that impacted on her personality, her outlook on life, and then what happened to her afterwards, and actually how the French pursued the divorce and the of Henry VIII and Catherine of Aragon, and the recognition of Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn's marriage really quite late on into what we know would be the end of Anne's life. But back to Anne's story, I think we need to resist it being so what happened to her, we must resist it being diminished in terms of how cruel and callous it actually was. So we're going to be looking at her story today, looking at the timeline a bit, of how all the events unfolded. And as well as the interview with Estelle to look forward to, you can go and check out some videos and interviews that are already on my channel. A good one to look at would be my interview with Gareth Russell. He's actually with me right this moment as I speak to you. He's my tour historian on the Anne Boleyn tour. He's incredible historian. If you haven't come across him yet, do check him out. Get hold of his books. One of the books which I think if you're a Tudor fan, you must read is his biography, Young and Damned and Fair, which is a biography of Catherine Howard. And what I wanted to speak to Gareth about, and what I did speak to him about in that interview, is the downfalls of Anne Boleyn and Catherine Howard. And we compared and contrasted them, and by doing that, learnt more about each of them. So that is a good one. You can check that out right now. I also have videos on how Anne Boleyn's love letters, in inverted commas, her letters got to the Vatican. And I do have a series actually charting Anne Boleyn's downfall over a four part. So you can check all of those out if you wish. But let's get on to the lady herself, Anne. And I've put here Anne Boleyn 1500? To 1536, because we're not sure when she was born, and there is lots of discussion about when she was born, and actually now more and more questioning whether she was actually the eldest daughter. So she has a sister called Mary, and it's been assumed until very recently that Mary was the elder sister. And there's more sort of evidence coming out that that might not be the case. And then we go into this with Estelle. The evidence for her being the younger sister is already quite thin. So it's quite, that's quite an interesting. But anyway, so I put 1500 something. Some people say 1501, and that date range tends to go up to something like 1507, which would have made her incredibly young when she goes off to Europe, which it makes it more unlikely. But anyway, that's something I go into with Estelle. So look forward to that. It's the 12th of May that that will come out for members of my Patreon, patreon.com/British History, which you can join now. It's a low monthly fee. And also that's an extended version of the interview with extra questions, but you can have the main part of the interview. It will be here free on YouTube, available on the 14th of May. And downfall again, like I said, it's a really familiar story, but it's very shocking. It's tragic. And I think if you watch, if you're like me, anytime you watch a drama, the Tudors or anything about Anne, you still get to the arrest and the trial and, of course, the execution, kind of hoping that there's a different outcome, even though, of course, we know there isn't. And that does help to bring home just what a horrible situation this was. Now, of course, we're understandably drawn to focus on her end, the dramatic end, and work backwards. Trying to understand how England got to the position where their queen could be killed effectively. Well, she was killed, but like murdered, really, judicial murder. Although someone will probably come back to me with what that actual definition of that is, but we'll get into that. I mean, her, I'll try and go through it and convey just the terrifying speed with which the end happened for Anne when it did come. I'm running two Anne Boleyn tours this year, and actually those between the two of them, they cover the entire time period when things happened for Anne. So through from the 29th of April through to the obviously the 19th of May. Now, she wasn't actually arrested, so she doesn't know there's anything going on until the 2nd of May. Then she's tried on the 15th of May, and she's executed on the 19th. She should have been executed on the 18th. I'll come back to that. So from her arrest to her execution takes less than 3 weeks. Now, of course, Anne is not the only one implicated in her own demise that we must think about, but there's five men as well also brought down, implicated, because Anne is supposed to have committed adultery. Adultery requires another person. And they didn't just go for one. They went for five, including Anne's own brother, George Boleyn, Lord Rochford. When Anne is arrested, she is here at Greenwich Palace. She, the bottom photo is looking from the Royal Observatory over Greenwich. That used to be a sort of pleasure mini palace, apparently, where Henry put some of his mistresses, but I don't know who was supposed to have been there. But anyway, and looking back over Greenwich. So nothing of the Tudor palace survives. If you are in Greenwich, by the way, and you look up to the Royal Observatory and you think that looks a Tudorish building, apparently some of the bricks from the old palace were used to build the observatory, hence why it might look a little bit Tudory. But Anne is here at Greenwich Palace when she's arrested on the 2nd of May. It's also Greenwich where she had given birth to Elizabeth in September 1533. It was a favourite palace. Henry VIII had been born there himself. It's situated on the River Thames. And Anne was watching a tennis match, a real tennis match or royal tennis match in the palace's tennis courts. And she receives a summons to go to the Privy Council. So if she hadn't had any suspicions by this point, she's probably thinking this is rather unusual. The Privy Council includes her own uncle, the Duke of Norfolk, and she attends the Privy Council and she's told that she's accused of adultery with three men. Mark Smeaton, the court musician or a court musician, Sir Henry Norris, who's actually one of Henry VIII's best friends, and the third man, curiously, goes unnamed. She's told that she's under arrest and she's going to be taken to the Tower of London. She leaves Greenwich in a barge at 2 p.m. to go along the River Thames to the Tower. Now, this is always an interesting point. These are my tour groups that I've taken so far. We've got another two this year and there'll be another two next year. So these photos will grow. But the reason I put I actually started off by going to the top right one, the one that says Anne Boleyn Tour May 2022. And that's our group outside of Traitor's Gate. And it's always one of these myths to bust that Anne came in through Traitor's Gate. Now, I've got an interesting, I think, take on the fact that actually it would have been maybe better for her. And there was a reason, an actual, more than she was royal, there was a reason or a benefit in bringing her in the way she actually came in. And I'll talk about that in a second. So she comes along the River Thames in the barge. It takes hours. I can't remember how many hours it takes. It's a ridiculous amount of time. They must have been going against the tide. The Thames is a tidal river. And she disembarks on a jetty. Now, it's a slightly different setup. Now, I think the walls are probably Victorian. I'm not sure. But because it's definitely come away from Traitor's Gate. Traitor's Gate is no longer a water entrance. It's cut off. But she disembarks on a jetty. She goes up through those steps you can see on the left-hand corner, updated, I think. So the left-hand photo, you can see the steps she comes with there. And she goes through the middle photo, if you see, there is a walkway and that goes into the Byward Tower. And that is the way in which Anne entered the Tower of London. And like I say, I've got a theory as to why, an additional reason why that was the case. Now, of course, she comes in. So she comes in on the 2nd of May. She never leaves the Tower of London, either in life or in death. So I should say that the photo on the right-hand side, you can see the archway on the right, and there is a door still in the stone wall, more into the centre of the photograph. That is the other side of the passageway that she would have come in through. And she's conveyed to the royal apartments, the same royal apartments that she was, that were renovated and she was in before her coronation in 1533. Her trial, did I get a photo of this? Yeah, sort of. So her trial takes place in the Great Hall at the Tower of London. There is no traces of the Great Hall that you can see now. It's in a very dilapidated state by the time James VI of Scotland becomes James I of England. There's quite a few reasons for that. Henry VIII isn't bothered by the Tower as a residence, certainly after Anne's downfall. Elizabeth isn't. She's incarcerated there herself during Mary's reign. So by the time you get to the end of the 17th century, the Great Hall is in a serious state of disrepair. Anyway, so it doesn't survive. So she's taken to the royal apartments. Now, if you have a look on the left-hand photograph, there is the White Tower. And there are two trees on to the right of the White Tower, with on the one sitting in the lawn, one sitting in the paved area. If you imagine a building going through the middle of those at right angles to the White Tower, this is where the royal apartments were that that Anne was kept in. And the Great Hall would have been in between where we are and those royal apartments. So now there is perhaps a misconception that Anne is very sort of stoic and mindful of legacy, somehow tells the future, is something depicted in some of the dramas, certainly thinking Anne of a Thousand Days, where she tells Henry that, of course, she doesn't see Henry, by the way. She never sees Henry again. She hasn't seen him on the 2nd of May when she's arrested, and she never sees him again. So all of those are kind of a fictional kind of probably where we sort of things we wish would had have happened. But certainly on the 4th of May, Anne is in this visible state of fear and dread, perhaps even hysterical at times. She has no sympathetic ears around her. In fact, not only does she not have people around her who are friends and sympathizers, everything she is saying is being reported back to the constable of the Tower, a man called Sir William Kingston, and via him to Thomas Cromwell, Henry VIII's chief minister, right-hand man. And his aim, his only aim, is to collect evidence against Anne and the men accused with her, or something to, I'll get onto it, but in much more detail, but the accusations against Anne and therefore against the men are so ludicrous that I don't think it is just to gather evidence that is the that Thomas Cromwell is having Anne spied upon. I think it's probably much more to do with controlling what is said about what is clearly fictitious slander designed to bring down the Queen. So not only is Anne in this unimaginable state of fear, she's on her own. She's only with people who, you could argue, seek her harm. She must have had thoughts of her little daughter, Elizabeth, who's just a toddler at this time. And whether she's ever going to see her again, what's going to happen to her daughter, all of these things must have been, would have been going through her head. Anne tried to find hope. She thought, she was wondering, perhaps this is a test by Henry. Surely the Henry she knew, who had moved heaven and earth, some would say literally, to marry her, wouldn't believe these accusations. Surely he would believe that she was innocent, and maybe she just needed somehow to prove that, for Henry to work this out. She went on to talk about the good deeds she'd done, and if death did have to come, then surely she would have a place in heaven. Trying to sort of self-soothe this talk to herself. She's trying to find reason in her situation. This is human, obviously, thing to do. Trying to work out why it would happen and put some kind of logic into even the most illogical situations. This is what she is doing. And find comfort. You know, if something does happen to me, then I'm bound to be going to heaven. Try and take comfort in that. Everything she thinks aloud is reported back to Cromwell. The men have been arrested at different times. Mark Smeaton was arrested first. Henry Norris was arrested, I think, the day before Anne, if I remember correctly. By the 4th of May, All of the arrests have been made, and now there are five men accused alongside Anne being held in the Tower. So Mark Smeaton has been moved there. He was originally held at Thomas Cromwell's own residence. So Mark Smeaton, Sir Henry Norris, Anne's brother, George Boleyn, Lord Rochford, Sir Thomas Wyatt, and Sir Richard Page. So five men were there at that time. And the charges against them all had to be read, obviously, at formal indictment hearings. Two juries had to be set up for these indictments because the way it works is there's one indictment per county, and the different royal palaces that they were saying these incidents of adultery happened at were in two different counties, Middlesex and Kent. Two juries, like I say, had to be set up, therefore, to hear these indictments. The orders for those juries had to be ready had been given in late April. So before any arrests had been taken place, on the 10th of May, the Middlesex indictment was read. It covered offences which were supposed to have taken place at Hampton Court Palace and Whitehall. And then the Kent indictment for the offences that had allegedly happened at Greenwich Palace, East Greenwich and Whitehall were heard on the 11th of May. Now, those indictments were almost identical. The charges were written in such a way that they painted Anne as this sexual predator, a protagonist, and the men, these sort of willing accomplices, but was very weak, actually. So not only was that morally reprehensible, though, on the part of the men, but it's against the king. And if you act against the king, then you're starting to go into the realms of treason. Now, the charges were purposely written to be incredibly lewd. So if you try to defend, they're written in such a way that if you were to try and defend Anne and these men, it sort of implicates the person somehow in condoning such behaviour. It all gets mixed. You see that in current affairs now. The jury sat. They predictably sent the men to trial, which again had already been anticipated, unsurprisingly, with a message to Sir William Kingston, Constable of the Tower, that the men were to stand trial. That message had already been sent. So four of the men, so all except for George Boleyn, were tried at Westminster Hall on the 12th of May. Westminster Hall is it survived, thankfully, this massive fire at the house at the Palace of Westminster in the Victorian era. It survived. That is still there. You can still go visit if you want to. So four of the men are tried there on the 12th of May. The men have no counsel. This was usual. And hadn't heard any of the detail of the charges against them until they were read out, which must have been shocking and appalling to them. At George's trial, of course, remember, he is being accused of having sexual relations with his own sister. So elevate that horror even more. Mark Smeaton, the court musician, was the only man who had confessed to having had sex with the Queen. He may have undergone torture. There's not records any narrative, any observation of injuries. However, it could have been psychological torture. There could have been threats to his family. There could have been threats to other people. There's other ways of doing it. He could have received false promises of leniency. But he was the only one who didn't dispute the charges. And according to the Spanish ambassador, Eustace Chapuis, we should know is Eustace Chapuis is no fan of Anne Boleyn whatsoever. at all. He's very, very loyal to his Spanish masters and Catherine of Aragon. He says, the others were condemned upon presumption and certain indications without valid proof or confession. You don't have to like or dislike the person who are being tried to understand whether due process and the law is being followed. And Chapri, interestingly, does make comment, does think that this is clearly, there's no proof. There's no proof. They haven't confessed. They're condemned on presumption and certain indications. All four men, predictably, that were tried on the 12th of May were found guilty, and they were all condemned to die at Tyburn, and die a traitor's death of being hung, drawn, and quartered. So I'll just take a sip of my tea. It is tea time, love. Oh, it's not live, sorry. I am live while I'm doing it. If you see what I mean. I still need a drink of tea. Now, on the 15th of May, it is Anne's turn, Anne and her brother George. Their royalty, their nobility, she's royalty, he's nobility. So they are tried at the Great Hall in the Tower of London. So they're not moved outside of the Tower of London, not by a jury, but by a council of their peers, headed up by the newly appointed Lord High Steward of England, their uncle, the Duke of Norfolk. Oh, this man. He'd been appointed 3 days earlier in order to oversee the trials of his niece and nephew. Now, 2 days prior to the trial, Anne's household is broken up. And on the same day that Anne faced her accusers, Henry, her husband, who was supposed to believe... I'm supposed to believe it's a love story. That's another conversation, perhaps for another day. I'm not convinced it's a love story, but Henry sends a message to Jane Seymour on the day of Anne's trial. He's installed Jane at Chelsea. He assures her that a message is going to follow later on in the day after 3 p.m., which will be the time that he can then confirm the condemnation of Anne. Anne's trial went first, so she goes first, followed by that of her brother. Both are incredibly intelligent and articulate people. And I still have to say that under the circumstances, if they'd have stood there frozen or cried or shouted, it would have been understandable. Apparently they both defend themselves very well. I think there's a book running on George getting off at one point, but I don't. Anyway, it's probably quite clear that's not actually going to happen, whatever he says. It's also at this point, it's in George's trial that we get the account of, George he's given a note, he's told not to read it out, and it's the accusation that Anne has told George that Henry is impotent. Along those lines, anyway, they're not the exact words. And he does read it out. I think he must have realised there's nothing that can be done. Let's go for it. And that's how we know about it as well. Of course, their defences were futile. I mean, we can tell from the timing of Henry's message to Jane alone that the decision was directed. It wasn't deduced. On the 17th of May, all five of the men were taken from the Tower to the permanent place of execution on Tower Hill. And I have a different photo to show you. This is the memorial to the execution site up on Tower Hill. And you can see there is Gareth giving... We go up to the Tower Hill site as well every time we... go to the Tower of London on the Anne Boleyn tour to talk about the men who could easily or are sometimes forgotten when we're talking about Anne Boleyn and her execution. And this was a permanent, like I say, scaffold site. and that this is where they were brought to on the 15th of May. And there's so their form of execution originally it was given as being hung, drawn, and quartered. That was commuted to beheading. I think George would always have been a beheading because of his rank, but the others were also beheaded, and they were executed in order of rank as well. So George goes first, and Mark Smeaton is the last one. He never takes back his confession, by the way. So this is where that happened. So you had George Boleyn first, followed by Sir Henry Norris, followed by Sir Francis Weston. Sorry, because I said Thomas White before. He was arrested, but he wasn't executed. It's the five men that are executed: George Boleyn, Lord Rochford, Sir Henry Norris, Sir Francis Weston, Sir William Brereton, and Mark Smeaton. And they're executed here. Now, there's always there's this discussion surmising that perhaps Anne could see the executions, and this of course comes about because of dramas, I suppose, made, and it makes for good TV. I think if you go there, and you have to imagine that there's actually a road at the moment now in between Tower Hill and the tower. Of course, that wouldn't have been there. So you have to try and imagine the landscape that what it would have been like in 1536. It's possible that Anne could hear the crowd that would have gathered to see these executions. Most likely, I would have said she could have heard the crowd. But from where she was being kept, unless she is somewhere different, she did spend some time, I think, with the Constable of the Tower in his apartments. But it's unlikely she'd have been able to, if she's in the royal apartments, she wouldn't have been able to see those horrific events. I think perhaps a small mercy. Anne begins to prepare herself for her execution. I'll come back to that, actually. She is due to be executed on the 18th of May at 9 o'clock in the morning. And during the early hours of that morning, she prays with her almoner. She gives a final confession to Archbishop Cranmer. I should also mention there is an annulment of the marriage. Henry likes to obliterate the memories or anything that says that something happened that he now wishes didn't happen. And it's possible that Anne is persuaded to agree to an annulment with Archbishop Cranmer. So she talks to Archbishop Cranmer, he gets her to agree to an annulment. Perhaps there are some promises here. You will be able to go to a priory, a nunnery, and live out your life by taking the vows. There could have been other things, you know. She may have been given promises. We don't know. That's guesswork. excuse me. But on the 18th of May, she gives her confession early in the morning to Archbishop Cranmer, and celebrates Mass. She takes the sacrament. She swears twice. She swears on the sacrament twice that she has never been unfaithful to the king. Cruelly, her execution is delayed by a day, so she isn't actually going to be executed until the 19th of May. She wasn't told that, though, until after the time that she was supposed to have been executed had gone by. That must have been very, very difficult. She's prepared for death. She's also got this potential hope. And then there's this delay. She does show incredible mental strength. I think to keep it together at all at this point, I think is amazing. She jokes about the prowess of the executioner. She says she hears that he is very good, and she has a little neck, and has a little laugh about it. But I would be tempted to say a laugh about it in a what would be the right word? I mean, she must be petrified at this point. On the 8th, at 8 a.m. on the 19th of May, she's told to prepare herself for death again. But anyway, and she's escorted out of the royal apartments. So the photograph on the left, apologies for those of you listening on the podcast, you can check this out on YouTube. But basically, Anne is brought from the royal apartments through what was a courtyard, which is on the south side of the White Tower. So the side that is now lawn, it's in between the White Tower and the River Thames, if you're trying to imagine it without looking at the photo. So she's brought from the royal apartments round the tower, up through Cold Harbour Gate, which no longer exists. That's on the, let me get this right, north, west side of the tower, the White Tower. The reason, it seems a bit cruel. It looks like she's been taken around three sides of the White Tower to get to her scaffold site rather than just being able to go at one side. But the Cold Harbour Gate was the entrance in and out of to access the royal apartments. So she's taken up through Cold Harbour Gate, and she's brought to a specially erected scaffold on the north side of the White Tower. And that, which would have stood somewhere between the White Tower and the Waterloo Barracks, which are there now. They obviously weren't there then. She delivers her final speech. If you watch my Charting Anne Boleyn's Downfall series, I read out her speech. What's the word I'm looking for? I don't know. I'm saying north. I've written down Western. Either way, so she's on the opposite side of the tower to where she had been kept. If you think about the Thames, Tower of London, so she's on the opposite side of the tower, at White's Tower, from the river. So the scaffold is specially erected. It's specially erected because they don't execute people inside the Tower of London, usually. So there isn't a scaffold there permanently. Anne gives her final speech in a clear, calm voice. She pays her executioner. She forgives him, which is customary. She removed her mantle. She removes her hood. She puts a linen cap on her head to cover up her hair, tucks her skirt under her feet, and one of her ladies puts a blindfold on her eyes. Anne sinks to her knees, as does the crowd led by the Lord Mayor, Sir John Aileen, don't know how you pronounce his name. And the crowd follow, which is a touching final show of respect. It's unfortunate Anne couldn't see it. Hopefully she could have sensed it. The only people to remain standing, Charles Brandon, Duke of Suffolk, Henry VIII's best friend, who had never actually been much of a fan of Anne, and Henry Fitzroy, Duke of Richmond, Henry VIII's illegitimate son by Bessie Blount. Anne began to pray, and the executioner called to his assistant to pass him the sword as a distraction. Anne turns, and the executioner dispatches his duty in one strike, and Anne's life, her worries are over. No coffin has been prepared for Anne. It looks like an astonishing oversight. It could speak to the fact that nobody thought this was actually going to happen. This is unprecedented. It's extreme. It's shocking. It's criminal. And so a bow chest is fetched for Anne's body and head to be placed in. She's wrapped in white linen, placed in the bow chest, and taken into St. Peter Ad Vincula, which is the chapel on site inside the Tower of London, and she's buried in a hastily dug grave there. Henry, far from being remorseful in any way, shape or form for the outcome of this and the execution of his second wife, he marries Jane Seymour 11 days later, on the 30th of May, so the month is not even out, and Henry marries Jane Seymour. Up on the screen at the moment, I have the photos of St. Peter Ad Vincula from the outside, and also a picture of it inside, looking up at the high altar. That is where Anne was buried. The glass monument, which is on the green outside of St. Peter Ad Vincula, is a monument. It is just that. It's a monument. It's not a placer. It's not to show exactly where this happened. And it's actually a memorial to all of the people who were executed within within the Tower of London at this time. And I've got some more close-up photos. So in the Victorian era, there was a big renovation of the chapel, and these floor plaques were put down for people who were known to have been buried there, not necessarily exactly over where the bodies are. There were hundreds of bodies in the chapel. Each May, a basket of red roses turns up from someone and is placed on the plaque to Anne. But no one knows who sends them, which is quite interesting. So, if I may, I have some final thoughts on Anne's downfall and that I think you might find interesting. So I didn't cover these in the main narrative because I didn't want to sort of break or detract from the story or overcomplicate it while we're going through them. But let's start off with the charges. So they're read in Kent and Middlesex. So they are ridiculous. Anne is supposed to be one of the most powerful and persuasive seductresses that has ever lived, according to the indictments. Her lust is so insatiable that she can't just have one lover. She has to have multiple lovers, including her own brother. All of them supposedly know about each other, but none of them, or she manages their jealousy through just giving them little gifts, promises of potential marriage after the king's dead, but surely only to one of them. She does this very quickly after giving birth. Some of the they give dates as to when things were supposed to happen, and then cover all eventualities by doing a catch-all and other times. Some of the dates they state, Anne was provably elsewhere. And add or onto this the fact that this is all supposed to have gone under unnoticed. Under the noses of Henry and the rest of the court. No one else is brought to trial for knowing about this but not saying anything, which of course is not the case in Catherine Howard. When Catherine Howard is arrested, Jane Rochford, Jane Boleyn, the wife of George Boleyn, is brought to trial as well. Watch that interview with Gareth if you want to. It's really good. It goes into that in a lot more detail. Now, I did promise that I would tell you a little bit more about my theory on Anne's entrance into the Tower of London. Anne's journey to the Tower of London is very public. She comes in by river. And I understand why people want to jump to her defence when it's said she comes in through Traitor's Gate. especially if you've looked into this and realized there was no basis for her actual for the accusations against her. But if she'd have come in through Traitor's Gate, she would have been out of the public's view. And I would suggest that the timing of her journey to the tower, it's in broad daylight. It's taken hours, so you kind of gone against the tide. It's at a busy time of day. And the choice of entrance is public. And my suggestion is that the reason that she's brought in such a public manner is that it's so bold that observers could only conclude that Queen Anne must be guilty of whatever crime she is accused. Let's talk about her execution then. So perhaps the only consolation that that Anne is given, besides the swordsman, the Calais swordsman is brought over to execute Anne. He's sent for before she's found guilty. So there's another piece of the puzzle. She's executed by sword, not axe, and she's given a private execution. However, I would also like to put forward a suggestion that that is more to do with protecting Henry than Henry's leniency or any kind of last minute act of kindness towards Anne. I think to know that a queen has been beheaded is one thing. For people to have actually observed the queen be beheaded would be another. We actually see this in the execution of Charles I. When it's happened, it's, oh my God, did that just happen? Did we really just do that? And I think there might have been a concern that that shock would have engendered sympathy for Anne and turn people against Henry. So those are things that I'd like to bring up about that. Now, she is someone who is endlessly fascinating. Of course, I wouldn't be doing the Anne Boleyn tour if I didn't think so, and if other people didn't think so. But I would love to know what your thoughts are, so please put them in the comments. And if you're not already, please do follow me on Instagram at British_history_tours. And if you're a member of my Patreon, we have talks during the tours. This first tour that I'm on currently, we're having talks from Gareth Russell, Professor James Clark, and Kate McCaffrey. And we go again on the 16th of May. And during that tour, again, we have talks from Gareth, Tracy Borman, and Kate. Those talks will be available in my Patreon, patreon.com/British History. I will also be releasing some of the talks from last year as well. The only reason I haven't yet is because we have quite a lot of lovely stuff in there. If you are interested, follow along this tour. If you're interested in coming on the tour, we're running two again next year. The dates are 29th of April till the 3rd of May and the 16th till the 20th of May. They're both co-hosted with the brilliant Gareth Russell. Not only is he a great historian, and he really, really is, he's a wordsmith, which makes me petrified every time I have to text him. And I text him quite a lot. Sometimes I just do a voice note just so there's no... Oh God, if there's a typo in there, just nightmare. So he's a great historian. He's a wordsmith. Wonderful. He's so entertaining. You haven't got a better dinner host. You know, he's great. We go to the Tower of London on the first tour. We go on the 2nd of May, which is, of course, the anniversary of her arrest. And on the second tour, we go on the 19th of May, the anniversary of her execution. We have talks next year. We certainly will be having Tracy Borman on the second tour, and we, as well as Gareth, of course, and Estelle Perron will be joining us on the first tour. We have a banquet in the Great Hall at Hever Castle. Hever Castle, if you don't already know, is Anne Boleyn's childhood home. Excuse me. We go on an after-hours tour of Hidden Hever, so we get to go behind the ropes. We get to go into some rooms that aren't on the visitor trail. This year, while I'm speaking to you, there are bits of the castle which are not open to the public at the moment while they reimagine they're doing stuff reconfiguring the castle. We're still going to get to go into those places. We also have expert guides meet us at Hampton Court Palace and Tower of London. We have the entire Astor Suite at Hever Castle for our own enjoyment, just for us while we're there. We're there for 4 nights, 5 days. So we've got a lawn there, which you can go and sit. So you're at the back of the castle, so you can sit, a view you wouldn't get if you're just visiting the castle. There's the moat in between you and the castle. It's really beautiful. We have a billiards room. Not that anyone's actually played billiards in there yet, but I'm up for trying. We have an outdoor heated pool. Go play croquet if you want. There's a tennis court, and you have the opportunity to dress up as Tudor royalty as well, if that is your bag. So if you're interested in joining us, you can go to britishhistorytours.com/history-tours, and you will find the dates and the details and how to book for both of those Anne Boleyn tours right now. So I'd love you to join us. Like I say, the talks though from the tours will be available in my Patreon, and I must give a shout out to Nancy, who has joined in the last couple of days. So welcome to Nancy. I will be back here live again next week. I'm talking about HMS Gloucester, the ship that nearly took the future James II down with it, and he potentially actually caused the death of other people. So we're going to, who couldn't escape. So we're going to talk about him. And tonight on History After Dark, of course, I am still away. So we have pre-recorded for tonight, but it's a good one. It's a good one. Isaac Newton. Didn't know he was so interesting. Very interesting. So if you go to History After Dark on YouTube tonight at 8:15, our normal time, then you will still see us there, and we're chatting about Isaac Newton. Please do go along and put your comments in. We'll be, the girls will be following along live. And I will see you here again live, though, next week, back for Tea Time History Chat. All right, everybody. Thank you so much for joining me. I hope you have a great week, and I will see you all really soon. All right. Bye-bye.